And welcome to another episode of Shadow Talk, your weekly cybersecurity news and threat research podcast, brought to you by the ReliaQuest Threat Research Team. I'm Kim, your host for this episode, and today I'm joined by Caroline. How are you, Caroline?
Hi, I'm good. Waking up a bit.
And it's early for you there.
Yes.
And also Brian, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks, Kim. Thanks for having me.
Good, excellent. Well, I'm pleased to have you both here for my hosting debut, so you can hold my hand through it. We've got another packed episode for you today. We're going to be discussing multi-factor authentication bypass techniques and what you can do about them. The reports that Microsoft has accidentally exposed 38 terabytes of data. And finally, we will have a discussion about a recent attack conducted by the Alfie ransomware group. Okay, so let's begin with our first topic. So on the 20th of September, which is yesterday as we record this, we released another one of our spotlight reports, this time focusing on multi-factor authentication or MFA bypass. This is the first of a two-part series on the topic, and while this first edition focuses on popular MFA bypass techniques and how to mitigate against those, the second will explore how threat hunting can help security teams identify signs of common MFA bypass methods occurring within their environment. Many organizations implement MFA to prevent unauthorized logins to their network, but unfortunately, it's not foolproof, and cyber threat actors have developed many techniques to bypass this technology. So, Caroline, can you explain for our listeners what some of the most common MFA bypass techniques are?
Yeah, sure. So we're going to go through four different kinds that we have predominantly observed in our customer environments. So the first one is going to be just simply getting the user to do it for you. I'm not sure. It's pretty common. If you have ever had your email compromised, if you've ever logged in and saw this device would like to log in, approve this MFA request. Those ones aren't really usually too successful just because users aren't very likely to click on an MFA request that they did not request in that context. However, there is another type, the next type that we'll discuss, which is MFA fatigue. So this one is kind of more focusing on getting the user, getting the user worn out from receiving all of these requests via push notifications and either accidentally hitting the accept or not being sure what to do or whatever, and just clicking accept on that push request. And then the next one is going to be token theft. So this is a pretty popular one that we've seen recently. If an attacker can steal a token that a user uses for their authentication process, they can bypass the typical requirement for MFA, as the MFA resource typically will recognize that token and let that user through. So we have predominantly observed this in the case of adversary in the middle attacks, where a user is phished with a fake login page and they're tricked to entering their corporate credentials. Those credentials are then proxied to the legitimate application, so our most popular example, Office 365, to begin an authenticated session. So as that authentication process is being proxied, this allows the attacker to harvest these user credentials along with the session information to bypass MFA. As we stated earlier, typically MFA apps will recognize that session information. This is another technique that we've talked on this podcast before. A variation of this is device code phishing, which I know that we mentioned back on our Black Hat talk. So if you're more interested in that technique, after you're done listening to this episode, you can go check that one out too. It has Black Hat in the name, so you'll be able to find it. And then the last one is targeting assets or services that don't have MFA. So an attacker can test their credentials against your various public service or applications to see if one does not have MFA. So Not all applications and environment are going to be configured the same. Some might have Okta covering them. Some might have another MFA application covering them. Or one might an application might have just been forgotten. Or the project to cover that application with MFA just hasn't gone through yet. That's another situation that we've unfortunately seen in customer environments as well.
Wow, thank you. That's super interesting. So many different ways for attackers to bypass MFA there. And so what do you think is the end goal? What are the threat actors going to be using that access for?
So attackers are primarily looking to achieve that initial access into the environment so they can begin working towards their end goal. And that can be any range of things. So with the adversary in the middle that we had mentioned before against O365, this can be as simple as an internal phishing campaign in the case of business email compromise, or if it's against, say, a VPN portal or something like that, attempting to escalate privileges and then move laterally for more serious compromises like ransomware deployment.
Nice. And so, Brian, can you give our listeners some recommendations on how they can mitigate some of the techniques that Caroline's just described?
Yeah, sure. So the obvious one, I suppose the first one would be user training, because I suppose some of these attack vectors heavily rely on the likes of user interaction. So like for a user's perspective, they should question, I suppose, this could be just myself as well, question absolutely everything. Like, am I supposed to receive this email? Do I typically receive emails like this? So I know the sender, you know, and I suppose the security team is there to be asked these questions. I'm pretty sure they'd prefer being asked questions on suspicious emails or, you know, MFA requests that they didn't sanction or issue themselves. They'd be more than happy to help rather than deal with an incident over the next couple of days and do God knows how many hours. And I suppose the next one would be token expirations. So limit the lifetime of tokens. MFA process enhancement require users to do more than one thing. Say, like, you know, not just accepting a push, but getting them to enter a code too. And then device certifications. So system administrators should assign certificates to expected recognized devices to prevent any other unrecognized devices attempting to authenticate.
Nice. And then as a little teaser for the next half of our Spotlight report, how do you guys think that threat hunting can help in these situations?
Yes. Yeah, so I suppose definitely identifying indicators of abuse of them is one thing, and being able to remediate from there. I suppose legacy authentication is still something that's used heavily, although it was announced by Microsoft that they were deprecating it. Just this week, we've seen abuse of legacy authentication, where we've seen, obviously, the actor get initial access and pivoting from there to send internal emails to further compromise the environment or the users in there, and then as well as that focus in attacks externally to hit different organizations. So being able to kind of spot that from a proactive perspective before anything really bad happens and taking actions on it is you know, next to nothing.
Caroline, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, sure. So this is probably going to like go for any attack technique, but for threat hunting, how it can help you, I think it forces you to put yourself into the adversary's perspective. And when you're like building a proof of concept and stuff like that, you're able to see like exactly how the logs would play out and how you can look for that in the future. So it's definitely helpful with seeing what exactly is going to happen and what you can expect to see in the future if you see these attacks again.
That's great. Thank you. Okay, so moving on to our next topic. Earlier this week, a company called Wiz Research claimed that while they were researching accidental exposure of cloud-hosted data, they stumbled upon a GitHub repository belonging to Microsoft's AI research division. And the repo contained an Azure storage URL that could be used to download code and AI models. However, that URL also exposed an entire storage account that contained 38 terabytes of data, as I mentioned earlier, and that data included employee passwords, secret keys, and I think around 30,000 Microsoft Teams chat messages. So if you think what you're sending to your teammates in Teams, do you want that to get out? I don't know. So, Ryan, can you explain for our listeners like what went wrong here? How were these researchers able to view all of that data?
Yeah, sure. So it's simply, I suppose, the single misconfigured SAS token. And for those listening, SAS tokens are used to grant permissions to these storage resources. So we can set them to, I suppose, access only certain files or a certain number of files. But in this case, they could access absolutely everything. So that gave the Wiz guys literally access to everything you wanted to see. And I think it kind of highlights, we have all these security checks in place prior to or to protect these sources, but one single misconfigured token can just literally give them, or I suppose, leave the vault door open and they can just jump straight in.
So Caroline, what are the security risks that are associated with SAS tokens?
So SAS tokens share a lot of the same risk that other types of tokens that we're familiar with. And a lot of this we can thank the cloud for. And I saw a meme this week that was going around on Twitter about different robust on-prem results or on-prem access controls. But cloud controls were easily thwarted with something like this. So I found that pretty funny and wanted to shout that out. But specifically because I've been doing a lot of research on different cloud resources. And I think two of the past hunts that I've focused on have focused on token abuse in cloud environments. But basically, it's all the configurations. So as Brian was stating, once the Wiz researchers got access to that, got that token, they had access to way too much with that token. So the people want to ask themselves, people who are configuring these type of things want to ask themselves, what does this token have access to? How long does that token live? What operations are permitted with that token? And those questions aren't really unique to SAS tokens. It's going to be the same thing with various types of services and AWS as well, like who has access to do what, and your IAM, who has access to access the Lambda environment, things like that. That is what I would say for the security risks that are associated with SAS tokens.
Thank you. So kind of getting a theme through this podcast that kind of simple mistakes by individuals are causing big problems across the board. And then I guess one for both of you out of my interest more than anything else. What do you think this data breach will mean for Microsoft? Are they untouchable or is it going to impact them in any way?
I think just for my perspective, Microsoft has certainly had a rough week. There's been a couple other things that have happened with them as well. And I certainly do not envy their security team lately. So special shout out to the hours that those people are definitely putting in. But they certainly are pretty much like the fixture in the tech world. And I don't really see that changing at all. I just really hope that at some point, organizations that are responsible for so much infrastructure that affect countless other organizations are truly held accountable for those choices. Obviously, we all make mistakes. But at some point, those mistakes kind of build up and can affect a lot of critical infrastructure. So I just hope that we can get to a point where these kind of things are prevented in the future.
Yeah, and I suppose in this case, we should be thankful that another research team has come across it rather than a bad actor and done goodness knows what with the information. What do you think, Brian?
Yeah, no, I have to agree. It's definitely been a rough week for Microsoft. I think, I suppose, just we need to make sure that they're held accountable as well. We do, a lot of organizations do, depend on them to make what they do possible. I suppose if there was another service that was available and offered similar things, but less kind of incidents like this, we may see moves, you know, to different organizations. But I think the main thing here is that a lot of people depend on them. So they kind of need to uphold that and, you know, remain accountable.
Yeah, sure. So fingers crossed, no more bad press for Microsoft in the next week. Okay. And so moving finally on to our last topic of this week's podcast. Unless you have been sleeping under a cybersecurity rock, you will have heard about a recent attack on a casino that resulted in some computer systems being shut down. So a couple of days after that news broke, the researchers VX Underground claimed that the attack was conducted after some pretty simple social engineering by the Alpha ransomware group. Many then put two and two together and suggested that an Alpha affiliate known as Scattered Spider was responsible. So Scattered Spider is known to impersonate employees on calls to their employers or the organization's IT service desk to try and obtain those MFA codes that we were speaking about earlier, or to get their password reset for initial access, which is what VX Underground reported happened in this instance. And the group Scattered Spider is well known for using SMS phishing and SMS SIM swapping attacks in its operations, as well as those vishing phone calls to try and get employee credentials or to get an employee to download some malware that will give them initial access. So what do you guys think about the threat from social engineering? Is it overlooked because it's so simple, and like, how effective is it? Yeah, what do you think? Let's discuss it.
So I personally think that social engineering is one of the biggest threats in the cybersecurity world, just because of how subjective it is. We can make firewall rules, push GPOs, make all the right configurations, but sadly, humans are imperfect, and that's all of us. So if you're a cybersecurity professional and you've claimed you've never in your life fallen victim to a single social engineering attempt, I really don't believe you. It's happened to all of us in like one shape or form, something super simple or not. And with regards to prevention, I think what really it leans on is obviously training to teach your employees how to recognize it. But as I said, we're all imperfect. So really, we also lean on defense in depth. So even if an employee is successfully phished with a social engineering attempt, there should not be a situation in which they make it all the way to a domain controller or something like that. There should be layers of protections in between those points to make sure that either that's prevented or alerted on to your security team.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, people do make mistakes. I think most people at some point in their life have clicked on one of those phishing email tests that the security teams like to try and trick us with, a bonus out of the blue. But the key is in not letting it get any further, right? And also, I think having a culture of openness where people can feel free to report those things if they happen, and not feel scared to, because they know they're not going to get in trouble for it as long as they report it early, so teams can do something to mitigate the bigger risk at play.
Right. Yeah, I definitely agree.
Brian, anything to add?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I suppose we put so much time and money and effort into like the security controls, but it's just the small slip-ups from, you know, the end users or even the help desk in that case as well. I suppose the security team stepping up and making sure that they're there for everybody to be able to ask questions, feel comfortable doing so, you know, kind of all makes, I suppose, security possible in that sense.
Yeah. And I think in this instance, VX Underground had said that the attackers had just gone on LinkedIn and found employee details on there and then called the service desk. So I think there's also some education around how much of yourself and your role and your team you expose online. And I've written blogs before about the amount of information people put in their out of offices sometimes as well. So like when big mass emails come out and suddenly a threat actor gets a reply that you're on holiday for this many weeks and this person's your boss and you can call them on this number, then that just plays into their hands, doesn't it? So the story doesn't end there though. That was one level of excitement, but we're taking it a notch up. A day later, while we, the threat research team, were conducting our regular trawl across the ransomware data leak sites, we noticed on the Alpha site that the group had made a statement called Setting the Record Straight. So the group in that post claimed responsibility for the attack, saying that those TTPs described that we've just talked about were not the ones that were used, and the attribution to Scattered Spider had actually been made incorrectly based on those incorrect TTPs. And now this is the first time that Alfie has publicly claimed responsibility in this way, which I think is really interesting. So what do you guys think drove the group to make this announcement?
I think it's because there was, I suppose, a lot of noise, and the majority of the noise being unconfirmed information, and the guys Alfie sitting on the other side seeing it. Like I think we need to say something. But it is strange that they actually have come out and said that they've, you know, we are the ones responsible. Whether just in this case it's specific because it was so much noise, or I suppose they're kind of coming out and claiming, you know, yeah, we did do this. This is us. We put our name on over or whatever. But it is strange.
Yeah. I think for cyber criminals, in my experience, their reputation is everything. And if they think that they've done something really clever in order to get access to the targets, and then it's that kind of downplayed and associated with somebody else, then that triggers ego, doesn't it? And they are suddenly maybe thinking, actually, no, we need to let people know what we're actually capable of. So also in that post, Alfie provided us with some details on the attack itself. So setting the record straight, the group stated it had been lurking on an Okta agent sniffing passwords before launching ransomware attacks against more than 100 XE hypervisors and exfiltrating some data. So seemingly Alfie gained access via the Okta agent. Is initial access via Okta something that ReliQuest has observed a lot before in your experience?
So via the Okta agent, I don't believe that we have seen that type of activity. Brian, you can correct me if I'm wrong. But certainly, I'm certain that we've seen employees get phished and access occur through Okta. But I don't think that we've ever seen like specifically access using that Okta agent. Brian, am I correct there?
Yeah, I haven't seen it in my time. I think it's definitely something that we have on our side that we get our, I suppose, customers to harden up on that side. But it's definitely something that we've never seen. But I can definitely see it in an avenue being explored, especially in this case anyway. And it seems to be quite successful.
Yeah, okay. I think I kind of put two and two together from Alfie's statement that maybe they got in through the Okta agent, but we don't actually know. So it's interesting to hear that we haven't actually seen it that often. So maybe there was a different initial access vector in this case. And what about XE hypervisors? Are those known for being particularly vulnerable to attacks?
So there has been several vulnerabilities that have come out for this, but I don't believe that this was related to that. It seemed that they pushed out their ransomware deployment through the virtualized environment. I think that is just an attack surface vector that they've found available to them and decided to carry it out that way. But I don't think it was specific to this incident. Yeah,
agreed. I think it's just another road essentially to distribute, I suppose, their payloads as opposed to a traditional kind of environment. It's just hypervisors rather than, I suppose, normal infrastructure within an environment. It's just another road they took to, I suppose, distribute their payloads.
All right, so maybe a bit more opportunistic and saw that there were several across the network and took the opportunity. So as always with ReliQuest, we like to educate people on what they should do in these instances. So what do you think organizations can do to protect themselves from ransomware attacks and attacks exploiting vulnerabilities or credential abuse?
As always, we're going to pitch our love for defense in depth. So starting towards beginning of the MITRE chain, so you want to be focusing on your defenses for initial access, things like enumeration, stuff like that, and then also like making sure that you have those controls in place for obviously privilege, least privilege, and then also making sure that you are up to date on everything in your environment. Your employees are trained to be able to recognize social engineering attacks, as we had mentioned before, and just really making sure that you have those controls at each step down the line.
Yeah, agreed with that, Caroline, on defense in depth. Another thing as well is knowing your environment. What's normal in your environment? What do you typically anticipate to see? And, you know, if you don't know your environment, you can't say that, Anydesk is running on this machine, but, you know, TeamViewer is running on the other ones. I'm not too sure which is permitted. You know what I mean? Having that kind of list there of what expected software is supposed to be in your environment, what's normal, kind of helps you identify, I suppose, anomalies regards to, I suppose, PTPs that are used by threat actors. And I suppose staying up to date with the TTPs that are used by threat actors will also let you come back into your environment and see what your coverage is like on that side.
Yeah, that's a really good point. As a threat intel analyst, I'm going to pitch for people to keep up to date with the latest in the cyber threat landscape and understand threat actors' behaviors and how they change their TTPs and how they, you know, try and configure their payloads to go undetected. And that all plays a really important part in that kind of 360 holistic pieces of the puzzle to defend against these attacks. Well, I think that brings us to a close, unless you guys have anything else to add.
I'm good.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with me and all the listeners today. And thank you to those of you that have listened all the way till the end. This week, we have released one blog, which is on domain redirection attack. So if you listened to last week's podcast, you would have heard the team discuss those in detail. So you can go and read that blog if you want to learn more about that. And then if you like what you've heard today from us, and if you found it informative and want to hear more, then please give us a like and subscribe to Shadow Talk on whichever platform you are listening to us on. It just really helps us to reach more people, find new listeners, and spread the good word about cybersecurity. Okay, thanks so much, guys. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks, Kim.
Thanks.